Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today, Matt Huber will talk about bringing class and the productive sphere into a mainstream climate movement that's obsessed with consumption choices. And Adam Kotzko will talk about the evangelical thinking behind the tendency's opposition to abortion. Before that, a few words on the crypto meltdown. I wrote a very skeptical, critical article on Bitcoin in The Nation in 2014. While I stand by the economic and political analysis, I had no idea that 8 years later the racket would not only still be going, but would become a phenomenon. A handful of coins blossomed into thousands and with insane spin-offs like NFTs. None of these instruments have ever really answered the question, what problem are they meant to solve? Crypto fails as money based on the classic definition of money's purposes. A medium of exchange, the universal equivalent in Marx's term, what allows you to buy and sell commodities of all sorts. A unit of account, what businesses and households keep their books in. And a store of value, an instrument for savings. You can buy little with crypto other than different kinds of crypto or drugs. Legalize drugs, which we should do, and that use would disappear. Almost no entity keeps its books in crypto, and you'd have to be nuts to park your spare cash in a unit whose prices typically vary by 28% a month, which is the case with Bitcoin over its 12-year history. Though it annoys partisans when you say this, crypto and all that are speculative instruments with absolutely no intrinsic value. Other financial assets have substantial speculative aspects, but they're also claims on something real. Stocks are claims on current and future corporate profits, bonds are claims on a stream of interest payments, futures are a claim on some underlying asset like a treasury bond or a bushel of wheat. Serious currencies are claims on things that you can buy with them, like food or an hour of labor. Crypto is a claim on nothing. Its value is merely asserted, often with almost religious fervor. As with any speculative asset, once the Federal Reserve stops showering the financial markets with trillions in free money and raise interest rates from zero, the crypto market began to collapse. It began slipping late last year as signs of Fed tightening became hard to ignore, but the slippage was at a leisurely pace. Now the wheels are coming off. So who's going to get hurt by this? We don't know how far the cryptomania has spread into the more mainstream branches of finance, and whether that's to the point of threatening a serious financial crisis. But we do know, from a Pew survey last November, that a lot of Americans have been playing with crypto, young men especially. Perhaps surprisingly, more of the black and Latino population have played with crypto than the white. They could have fallen for the touts line that these bizarre instruments would somehow democratize finance. Reddit is already full of tales of people who have lost everything and are contemplating suicide. One's feelings are very mixed here. Sadness over a slaughter of the innocents, a what-were-you-thinking incredulity, and a joy that some promoters are going to take a bath. A final point, crypto is deeply mixed up with far-right politics. It's scary to think about how such a well-armed population, already brimming over with rage, will react to these losses. Enough of me. Matthew Huber, a professor of geography at Syracuse University, is just out with a book, Climate Change as Class War, published by Verso. It is a call to center class and production into a political movement where, at least in the mainstream, consumption and individual action have been central. Too often, moralizing replaces serious political organizing and considerations of power. Matthew Huber. You're basically trying to bring class into the environmental movement, where it's been notoriously absent, both in the analysis of the damage, but also a lot of the politics in responding to the environmental and climate crisis in particular. What is missed? There's so much focus on individual behavior, individual action, live a more gentle relationship with the earth. What are the limits of that kind of politics?
Well, when I started looking at this, you really could boil down the climate crisis to a struggle over really industrial production, you know, how we produce energy and how that energy is provisioned to various forms of other production of food and housing and whatever else. And when you start thinking about Marxist or socialist class theory as rooted in the relation to the means of production, the fact the working class is trying to struggle to seize the means of production, it really struck me that this is a really helpful way to think about this ultimate struggle over how we produce energy and in our lives. But as you said, the way in which class is analyzed with regard to the climate crisis really makes it only about actually how people use their income in the realm of consumption, what their lifestyle choices are, and you have all these sophisticated tools of carbon footprint accounting to kind of measure the emissions that are embedded in consumption patterns. And that does show a really high levels of inequality between rich consumers, rich countries, and poor consumers. But it doesn't really tell us much about class in that traditional Marxist sense in terms of who owns production, who profits from the production that provisions our consumption. And also, like, we really need to focus a lot more on how did these rich people get so rich in the first place? How did they actually generate the money that allows for their Hummer or their private jet or whatever their high emission consumption activities are? And if we looked at some really rich people that might be, you know, let's say a CEO of a chemical company, they probably spend 8 to 10 hours a day managing a global network of highly carbon intensive, emission intensive facilities across the world. And that's got way more impact than whatever steak they might eat or flight they might take out when they get out of the office, right? So there's this weird way in which we only focus on people's consumption as the zone of responsibility, as the zone of choice and politics where we can actually shape different choices. But really, the bulk of emissions, the bulk of power over our energy system is really these owners who control production, who are hell-bent on maintaining those systems of production to maintain their profits for deep into this century. And so using this very sort of basic old Marxist way of thinking about class is actually really much more helpful than this kind of income consumption-based one that we hear a lot about.
Well, people like us have been lamenting the disappearance of class from politics and from social analysis for several decades now. But something else has disappeared in a lot of these analyses is production. I mean, you alluded to this, but everybody talks about consumption, of course. But lately, there's been a trend also towards talking about the asset economy. And production and the labor relation disappear or take a back seat to this idea of debt and assets. What are we missing by writing production out of our analysis?
A lot, particularly for someone like myself who's trying to kind of understand the ecology or whatever of capitalism or the relation between capitalism and the environment. I mean, it's ultimately a relation of production and how we produce our material existence. This is basic stuff. You know, I totally agree about this kind of asset economy analysis, which has a lot of insight, I think, about how money and wealth work in our highly deindustrialized economy. This monetary wealth that could be wrapped up in whatever the stock market or housing does not really give us a deeper sense of actually where the value is being produced in a global economic capitalist system. It doesn't give us this understanding that Marx's political economy does that ultimately, you know, you have to look at that hidden abode of production to see exploitation in the workplace as the sort of source of surplus value and value that's then sort of churns around the globe and all these financial channels. And so that's what Marx's analysis was really useful for. He really like pointed out that classical political economy kind of was really fixated on exchange relations and the surface of markets, and they weren't really getting deeper into the actual class struggles that shape the actual production of life itself. And so I feel like, you know, we live in a context in the United States that's gone through widespread deindustrialization, this sort of shift to a so-called post-industrial kind of knowledge economy, where consumption does make up something like 70% of GDP or whatever people say it does. And so people have become so distanced from production, have gotten so used to not even thinking about it, that it's totally evacuated our class analysis at the same time. And that's again, a real problem if we want to confront the climate crisis or the environmental crisis, which ultimately hinges on our relation to material production.
One of the byproducts of that knowledge economy infects climate politics. You talk about this at some length. The emphasis, particularly in kind of a bourgeois professional class environmentalism, the emphasis on the science, the knowledge. It's a matter of just getting people to understand the facts. Any notion of power in politics disappears from that kind of analysis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's no surprise that as society is deindustrialized, as the industrial working class has been kind of hollowed out and disempowered, you've kind of seen the rise of the professional class and the rise of higher education as shaping this kind of wedge in the labor market where professional class people try to carve out some degree of advantage in a highly unequal and barbaric capitalist neoliberal system. And so the people that take advantage of degrees and other professional credentials, these are the same people that are most vocal about climate politics, and they, and it's really no surprise. Like, highly educated people with advanced degrees tend to focus a lot on knowledge and the science and getting the facts right, and that sort of becomes the stuff of politics. You know, like in the Trump years, you had this. People were probably most upset about not his sort of massive material deregulation of the oil and gas industry, but the fact that he was waging a war on facts and that we were going to have a march for science and all this kind of stuff. So the climate movement has really focused a ton on belief or denial of the science, as if that is really what the struggle is about. And if we could just sort of convince everyone of the truth of climate change, that would automatically lead to widespread political change or political action. But I point out in the piece that knowledge isn't always actually power. Sometimes climate activists get almost most upset that the fossil fuel industry is like financing climate denial campaigns and denying the science, than the fact that they're actually much more materially building political power by, you know, contributing to state legislature campaigns and building, you know, you can talk about the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers. They're actually like, you know, using money to build real material political power. And yeah, they're also financing a bunch of scientific skeptics who like cast doubt on climate change. And that's terrible. It's bad, but it's really not the core of the problem. The core is that they have power and that they are using that power to prevent widespread action on the climate issue. And that's where we really need to focus.
Continue beating up a bit more on the liberal environmentalists here, because I enjoy it, but it's also quite important, I think, if we want to have a serious climate movement here. A lot of the like NGO environmental people focus on very marginalized populations, indigenous people, and very poor urban populations. And God knows, you know, these people get a raw deal from the system. I'm not trying to excuse that. But they also lack any kind of significant power, actual or potential. I remember I went to a conference at the Rockefeller Estate a few years ago. And we're sitting in this house that Carbon built under Picasso tapestries. And there's exactly that kind of scene with NGO staffers evoking the most marginalized populations. They never seem very interested or almost uncomfortable with or hostile to the middle 70 or 80% of the population, which is what you really need to get involved in changing anything. I mean, what about that? Why do you think they have this obsession with people who really have very little in the way of social power?
Yeah, I fear it's quite a sort of moral politics that they're invested in, and sort of, again, amplifying and raising the visibility of the most oppressed and the most marginalized. And as someone who hangs out in academic and these kind of professional class and NGO circles, I mean, nowadays, basically all the focus is on what people talk about as environmental justice, which means, you know, really focusing on what climate activists call the frontline communities that are bearing the brunt of the worst effects of climate change, bearing the brunt of the worst effects of like the toxic fossil fuel infrastructure. And that's super important to highlight, and the struggles over those frontline communities are like important. But as you mentioned, like, these people are oppressed enough. We can't also expect the most marginalized to be able to build the power in a mass social movement to take on the fossil fuel capitalists who are actually poisoning them. So what I argue in the book is that this kind of what I call it livelihood environmentalism, where this idea that environmental politics will emerge from people's direct material threat, environmental threat, like whether it be toxic pollution or some sort of, you know, like land dispossession that you talked about, like indigenous peoples, like this is where a lot of the NGOs and academics think like is what authentic environmental politics is. But I point out like the main threat to people's livelihoods and capitalism is not necessarily pollution, but the market itself, the lack of money, the fact that people struggle to afford food, healthcare, housing. And so I argue that we really need to broaden climate politics toward this, what I call kind of proletarian ecological politics that really takes the fact that the mass of the working class are really dispossessed from the means of production, from the land, from any sort of secure survival and existence. And so that they're really struggling to meet their basic needs in the market, you know, to get enough money to afford food, housing, energy, especially now with inflation raging. And if we can ground climate politics more in this broad-based proletarian insecurity, we can actually offer a political program that appeals to a much broader base that could maybe build that kind of power and not put it all on the marginalized, oppressed populations to build that power. And the other really convenient thing about this approach is that if you look at what we need to do about climate change, essentially the sectors we need to decarbonize are exactly these sectors that working class people have such insecure access to, like food, housing, transportation, and above all, energy. And, you know, if we can try to build the type of power that is offering more secure access to these things, whether it be green public housing or public transit, or in my socialist dream, decommodified access to electricity as a human right, that this would really be very easy to understand as an improvement to people's lives on a much broader scale. People wouldn't even need to understand the ins and outs of climate science and the greenhouse effect to be on board with that kind of politics. So that seems to be a much more broad-based and mass politics approach to climate action.
I'm speaking with the theologian and philosopher Adam Kotsko. I'm speaking with Matthew Huber, author of Climate Change as Class War, just out from Verso. Now, this brings me to my next problem with this kind of liberal Rockefeller environmentalism. I used to talk with Ron Arnold. Ron Arnold was a publicist, basically, who invented the concept of wise use, libertarian anti-environmentalism. I believe People magazine once named him the number one enemy of the earth. But Ron was very successful in his agitation, in his anti-green agitation, by quoting Rockefeller environmentalism, and he saw it as a kind of austerity program that a lot of the Rockefeller environmentalists viewed the working class as a problem, and they needed to tighten their belts. There was a lot of truth to what Ron was saying, wasn't there?
Yeah. I actually quote Charles Koch, who was quoted in the Washington Post saying that what I'm concerned about is that the poor pay a third of their income to energy, and this climate policy stuff's really going to hurt the poor. So, Charles Koch is sort of positioning himself as a friend of the poor and, you know, trying to help the working class by blocking climate action. If anyone mobilizes sort of core class politics in the climate fight, it's the right, right? It's like from George W. Bush on through Trump, like at all times, like resistance to climate policy always is framed in economic terms. It's going to cost us jobs. It's going to cost economic competitiveness. And above all, it's going to like raise the cost of living for everyday good working class Americans. It's a very easy argument to make when a lot of liberal climate policy technocratic people are in fact arguing for things like carbon pricing and carbon taxes that they might have wonky solutions to kind of redistribute the revenues to households. But ultimately, it means they want to raise the price of energy for people. And that is an incredibly easy policy program to villainize as liberal, elite, out of touch with everyday working people. It's sort of amazing. It's somewhat depressing that these climate policy people that want to implement really what are free market policy ideas like carbon taxing and carbon pricing, they're trying to actually win right wing support and, you know, God bless them, Republican support for climate policy, which is
good luck with that.
Exactly. And they think they can actually like build this bipartisan, not to name names, but I focus on this organization called Citizens Climate Lobby, who think they're going to build this bipartisan carbon fee policy and they're going to attract Republican support. It's hilarious. They're sort of falling into the very trap that the right is bringing them into by focusing on carbon taxes and carbon fees. They're saying that they want to make energy cost more. And that's just a very easy thing for the right to mobilize this kind of populist reaction to and say, again, environmentalism is about making your life cost more. And let's resist this. So, yeah, it's a real sad story. And it's been going on for decades, right? This kind of idea that, oh, everyone agrees carbon pricing is the obvious thing we need to do. And the right keeps pointing out how disastrous this would be for working people.
Yeah, now let's look at a better way of doing things, the Green New Deal, which almost seems like a relic of several years ago now, I'm sorry to say. But, you know, it was a good idea and could be again. But it was focusing on at the same time addressing the climate crisis, but also improving the security and living standards of the mass of the population. And that story got lost, you know, the right's objections to the Green New Deal. They're going to take away your hamburgers, they're going to take away your Hummer, all that sort of thing. But that's really not what the Green New Deal was about, right? I mean, it was a much more positive vision than that kind of hair shirt environmentalism the Rockefeller crowd like.
Yeah, I recall, you know, those heady days in 2018 when AOC sat in with the Sunrise Movement in Pelosi's office. And, you know, I really felt like there was a breakthrough. I finally felt like there was a climate politics that was actually trying to, like, do this very basic working class program. Liberal professional class people got really upset that they put things like Medicare for All in the Green New Deal resolution as if it should be this very narrow technocratic climate policy alone. But they also put things like a job guarantee, things like, you know, way higher levels of paid vacation time. These are universal public goods that would by themselves generate much popular support. But here's the catch, right? The whole theory of change of the Green New Deal is that to build this kind of popular support for climate action, you actually have to start delivering these big, ambitious public goods, these big jobs programs and forms of public investment. And as long as you don't deliver those material gains, we found out that working class people are probably rightly going to be skeptical that this is realizable, that it's possible. It's a challenge to actually start building that theory of change by starting to deliver. And so when, you know, ultimately a lot of the climate movement got behind this kind of Bernie Sanders gambit at the presidency, and that failed, you know. And I think if Bernie was elected, he would have tried to do something along the lines that AOC and others were focused on. But he lost. And if you look at what Biden has done, he has really just doubled down on this narrative that, yes, climate change is real. We believe science. But really, we're going to leave it to the private sector to solve. This is something Janet Yellen and John Kerry have just spouted over and over again, that they say government can't solve this. It's going to be private capital to the rescue. And for all the benefits of the now failed and destroyed Build Back Better Act, all the climate policy that was in there that a lot of activists were excited about, and it was going to be a historic level of spending, most of that spending was going to be for tax credits to private renewable capital to do the green energy transition for us. And it wasn't at all this Green New Deal vision of, again, public investment, public goods, public jobs programs. And so we lost that kind of gambit for a large scale Green New Deal. And we've got to just sort of sit back now, and maybe the winds of political change will shift. And, you know, I think what Bernie and others were trying to do was really a widespread political realignment of American politics that hasn't, you know, it's taken place maybe once every few decades in the 1930s and the 1970s, the turn to the right and neoliberalism. I mean, it still feels like we're in this kind of middle period where it's not clear if we're going to go towards some much more darker sort of right-wing direction or a left-wing realignment. So I think that might still be on the table down the line, maybe a few years or even a decade. But in the meantime, the reason I think that this failed was that there wasn't really a lot of existing working class organization and institutional power already built up to actually have the power to deliver something like the presidency in the heart of empire, right? So what we have, there's no shortcuts, as Jay McAlevey would say. Like, we actually, now that we lost that really high level battle, we actually have to get back to basics and start building unions back up, which we're starting to see, start building things like the kind of institutional presence of labor political parties that exist in a lot of countries, not ours, of course, but something like that, some sort of institutional presence in working class people's lives that they can see on a day-to-day level and that can start to deliver real gains so that they can start believing in a kind of a program that actually tells them, you know, if you get into this movement, you will see your life improve and actually delivers, and then builds confidence amongst the working class that they can actually win these gains. Because I think nowadays working class people really feel kind of hopeless, and it's hard to blame them. You know, the there's been just decades of defeat, and capital has been quite triumphant for quite a while.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but you mentioned that the quote from Kerry, it's all going to be the private sector that's going to do it. You know, Janet Yellen saying similar things. In fact, we need a very active state that's going to step on the toes of capital, or none of this is ever going to get done, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I thought finally, like, the climate movement had figured this out in 2018, 2019, and there was this real move. You know, everyone was talking about the New Deal as the model, or even World War II, you know, like, where the state basically commandeered much of the industrial production system and said, you know, you must produce X, you must do Y. And, you know, like, the New Deal itself was this incredible sort of era of public investment where they were actually building energy systems to, you know, hydroelectric dams to deliver energy, cheap energy to poor people in the country. You know, the Tennessee Valley Authority's slogan was electricity for all. It was this really populist vision about improving people's lives through energy, through electricity. And in fact, that's exactly what we would need to do to solve climate change. We need to build essentially an entirely new energy and electricity system. And if we can kind of think back to that, the how the state and how the public sector, not only in the U.S., but in many other contexts, whether it be Scandinavia or France, or, you know, the public sector has been able to really transform energy sectors dramatically in ways that improve working class life. And that's the model that I think we need to look back to if we can ever get people like John Kerry out of power.
Yes. Good luck with that one, too. Okay, well, thank you. That was Matthew Huber, professor of geography at Syracuse and author of Climate Change as Class War, just out from Verso. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the first movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 7, performed by the Emerson Quartet. With reproductive rights very much in the news, I thought a look at why evangelicals, the principal force behind the movement to criminalize abortion, are so obsessed with the issue. To explore that question, we're joined by Adam Kotsko. Kotsko, who teaches in the Scheimer Great Book School of North Central College in Illinois, grew up evangelical. He was on the show to talk about that experience back in December 2019. He was also on the show a year earlier to talk about his book, Neoliberalism's Demons, a theological look at free market ideology. Adam Kotsko. I have a simple question, I guess has probably a long answer. Why are the evangelicals so obsessed with abortion? Where did it come from to start with, and why is it such a central obsession?
Yeah, I think that one thing that's really interesting, I've been researching this question a bit since you asked me to do this, is that it wasn't always the case. Back in the 70s, abortion was considered kind of a fringe Catholic issue, and most evangelicals were kind of had a reasonable moderate view of this issue. I think that it was part of a concerted campaign of political activists who wanted to try to mobilize conservative Christian voters to support Republican politicians, and they were kind of casting about for an issue that would both energize evangelicals and have kind of a veneer of respectability. So initially they tried to attack attempts to desegregate schools, which fell especially hard on like religious schools that tried to use a religious exemption in order to stay segregated. And that made evangelicals mad, but it also kind of made them look bad, you know, because at that point open racism wasn't as acceptable. But I think that part of the reason that abortion resonated when it finally did become a big part of the religious right movement is that it combined a lot of anxieties about sexuality, about government intervention into the family, and also it gives them a pure, innocent victim that they can claim to be representing.
Sometimes it seems the attitude towards the fetus, it's once you're born, the hell with you, you're on your own. But the fetus once born is like almost like a new car losing value once it's driven off the lot.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's really a great analogy. And like, there's just such a fetishization of the fetus. And I think it's the fact that nobody has met the fetus, that the fetus doesn't have any friends or enemies. The fetus hasn't done or said anything yet, that it's this pure, innocent, like just humanity that you can project your fantasy of what it could have been. A lot of the rhetoric is, imagine if one of these babies that was aborted would have cured cancer or would have been the next Einstein or something like that, when more likely it's just going to be another mediocre person like those around you.
Yeah, but you know, they don't have the same attitude towards some kid growing up poor who could also be the next Einstein. It's just the unborn kid that attracts all his interest.
Yeah, I think that it's also attractive because it doesn't make any demands on you. The fetus does make the demand of, like, don't kill me or something like that. But once it's born, it's somebody else's problem, right? Leave it up to them. And I think that that's really interesting because if you look at certain, like, kind of left/religious types who want to maintain an anti-abortion stance but says, like, well, socialism would solve this, they're not interested in giving more support for the family. They're not interested in helping these people make pregnancy more possible. There probably are people who do get abortions who would like to have the child but can't afford it, and that's a shame. Like, people should also be able to have the children they want to have, but that simply isn't on the agenda.
You grew up in the evangelical environment. Was there much talk of abortion, the fetus? Was it an obsession? How prominent was it in the discourse that surrounded you in your younger days?
It was definitely always a point of reference and always a kind of political trump card. My church was aiming at a kind of, like, socially mobile respectability such that, like, taking a busload of people to protest an abortion clinic just seemed, like, tacky or something like that. So I wasn't really directly on the front lines of that, and I'm grateful in retrospect that that didn't occur because I was just a kid. I would have gone along with it, right? There were posters on the wall that had American casualties in the Civil War and World War II and Vietnam and like deaths in the Holocaust and then like deaths in the war against the unborn, and it was like way more this kind of constant invocation that there's like this genocide going on that Democrats and most mainstream institutions want it to happen, and we're somehow like on the vanguard of like saving these lives. It was just a kind of attractive fantasy and also an excuse for, you know, always voting Republican no matter what. No other issue could possibly dislodge evangelicals, even to this day.
The support for Trump, who is, you know, about the most immoral man you could imagine on most conventional definitions, but because he is going to appoint pro-lifers to the Supreme Court, that trumped everything, right?
Yes, exactly. And what's really interesting is among evangelicals, they have no historical sense. There's just a two-year trailing window of history at best. They get to forget everything they knew about Trump from him being a public figure for decades and decades. You've seen these paintings, right, that show Trump as this heroic American Christian hero who's, like, instructing the youth and all this. It's kind of like Kim Jong-il or something like this.
They're really bizarre.
It is, but I think they have to reconcile it and make him into the kind of Christian hero that they think he is simply because he's appointing these judges. And I think it's really ironic that now that the justices do seem poised to overturn Roe, that Donald Trump, the billionaire playboy, like gleefully boastful sexual assailant, is going to probably go down in history for them as the greatest Christian American ever.
Who no doubt paid for abortions with his lovers, but, you know,
1,000%.
That's never brought up. You mentioned this, that abortion was not a significant issue for evangelicals until probably the late 70s, as they were really breaking onto the national scene. I remember watching, when I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, late 70s, watching Jim Baker and Pat Roberts on the TV. We just laughed at them. We didn't think these guys were going to be of any broader political significance. They were just late-night entertainment, but you know, who knew? How did they assimilate this new concern into the pre-existing dogma? Was it how does this view of the fetus fit into and the mother? How does it fit into evangelical doctrine?
You don't have to scratch very far to get to the idea that pregnancy is a kind of punishment for having sex, and that you shouldn't have had sex, and therefore you shouldn't be able to evade the consequences of having sex. I think that they're picturing that the person seeking an abortion is always going to be like this kind of unmarried woman, therefore morally questionable to start with, who was irresponsible and is trying to get out of it. That kind of like misogyny gets overlaid with the sentimentality about babies, because they do think of, you know, they speak of the fetus as though it's already a baby, even an embryo, which is, you literally cannot even see it because it's so small. They think of it as like killing your baby or something like that. So they're taking what is a potential future human life and already projecting that it is the cute baby that is already your responsibility. That's also your divinely ordained punishment for having been a slut. And it's just like all these weird cross currents of resentment and sentimentality that come together into the, so that I think if you talk to a pro-lifer, they're constantly switching positions. Like, their position is incoherent if you try to state it all together, but it gives them this constant leverage to always have something to respond that sounds good in the moment. And since they think that leaving somebody speechless and frustrated means that they've won the argument, that's satisfying to them.
No, draw out the incoherence. What's incoherent about the position?
Viewing the fetus as though it's already an independent entity that has rights over against its mother. I think that you either have to choose that the mother is a human being who has rights over her own body, or the fetus is a being that has rights to demand the services of her body. And they never quite want to go there. They never, like, if you press them on that, I've talked to pro-lifers who say, why should a person's rights depend on the location that they happen to be in? As though being gestating within another human being is just, you happen to be like in a room over here or something like that. It's like making the woman to be just an inert container.
They wouldn't take that kind of generous attitude towards prisoners.
No, certainly not.
What's the mix of concern over the fetus with the desire to control women? Are these things just a nice synergy, a political synergy for them to be able to accomplish those two goals at once?
I mean, there's a whole line of feminist criticism that says that it is precisely women's association with pregnancy and therefore with raising the child that has historically put them at a disadvantage and put them in a position where they're vulnerable to subordination and things like that. I think it was stated rather nakedly in this infamous New York Times column, and he said, yes, the abortion ban is going to have destructive consequences, but it's totally worth it because we're saving lives. And one of the things he mentioned was like a greater number of shotgun weddings were likely to occur.
That would be a good thing.
He phrased it as though that was one of the potentially bad consequences, but I think if you read it as a whole, it's very ambiguous whether that would actually be bad, because he probably does want to return to traditional morality where marriage is the only forum where sex happens. And, you know, a shotgun wedding is kind of retrospectively trying to say, well, we already were married, or it causes us to be married or something like that, to try to close the gap between sexuality and marriage.
And a lot of reproductive rights people will try to plead with the pro-lifers by saying, don't you understand that women are going to suffer and die from illegal abortions? Is that a very fruitful approach, or do they not care, or might even think that suffering is deserved?
If forced, they would say, well, that's a shame. but also, you know, they're doing something against the law. I think that there's a lot of magical thinking about how the law works, as though simply the fact that it's written down means that people have to do it. Like if you try to say, well, you know, what would really reduce abortions is increased contraceptive access and greater like support for young families and all of this. They're never going to buy that because they think that if there's a law, then it won't happen. And if it does happen, then the state is going to be punishing the right people in the right way for it happening. So they would just say, you shouldn't have been doing that. You know, you should have thought of that kind of thing. It's personal responsibility suddenly arises in this discussion.
Now, they also, now it looks like victory on Roe is at hand. Now they're talking about banning contraception. Has that always been an evangelical obsession, or is it gaining new prominence now?
No, I think that actually, you know, in 1968 is when the Pope unexpectedly declared that birth control was not permissible for Catholics, and abortion was kind of part of that discourse. Like, since birth control is not permitted, of course, abortion as the most, the last resort of birth control is not permitted too. And that position seemed crazy to even a lot of Catholics and didn't have a lot of purchase. And I remember growing up, like a lot of people would say, you always had the option of birth control, so why would you, why should you get to have an abortion simply because you chose not to have birth control or something like this, as though birth control never fails, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of magical thinking, a lot of kind of that everything works 100% of the time or whatever. But I have frankly been pretty surprised by this, and I think it might be due in part to the growing alliance between Catholics and evangelicals, that this kind of anti-birth control agenda is gaining a little bit more purchase, because I think that where the Catholics have tried to make the birth control position more plausible to their evangelical allies, it's through likening the prevention of like implantation of the fertilized egg as a form of abortion. It's kind of likening all birth control to kind of a proto-abortion, rather than the initial position was that abortion's not permitted because it's a kind of birth control.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the Catholics, because you know, the majority of the Supreme Court now is conservative Catholics. The opinion is written by a conservative Catholic. He's got conservative Catholic allies in the court. How do evangelicals feel about that? It used to be that, you know, the papists were evil. Is this just an alliance of convenience?
It's really evolved over time, and I think that as Catholics have become more right-wing, at least their leadership has become more right-wing, I think that it's become less a marriage of convenience and more a genuine appreciation. I think that it's also interesting that Mormons have been brought into the fold when they are even further beyond the pale. Like, I think growing up, and even probably today, if you asked an evangelical, they'd say that Mormonism was a kind of cult, not a real form of Christianity. And yet, Mitt Romney was a good, you know, vehicle of convenience for this, too. And Mormons were very decisive in some referenda about, you know, sexual issues as well.
I remember when I interviewed you a while back, that you said there were some evangelicals envied the sophistication of Catholic theology. That's like, is that part of it?
I think that there is a bit of that. One thing that any evangelical who becomes at all intellectually engaged and, you know, engaging in this kind of anti-abortion arguments and rhetoric, you do have to think it through at least a little bit, right? And I think that you come to realize how little history and how little tradition and just how little there is, especially, you know, given that it's as though there were three moments in history before now, which is the creation, Jesus's lifetime, and the founding of the United States, and everything else just doesn't matter. Not even like Martin Luther or something like that. All of that just doesn't really matter. And there's this like immediacy of like you have access to the simple gospel message, but the simple gospel message that they're preaching is pretty thin gruel.
Well, the founding of the United States, is that because the United States is part of the divine mission?
Yeah, it's a Christian nation, definitely. I mean, that was a huge part of the rhetoric, too, is that America is intrinsically a Christian nation, and this creeping secularism is, like, betraying the reality of what America is. And so in a way, like evangelicals in seeking that law should echo evangelical teachings or that Christianity should have special pride of place in public life, they're not arguing for special favors. They're just arguing for how it always was and how it always should have been. And actually the people who oppose it are doing something new and different and innovating and betraying the founders.
Now, there's some people on the left who react to this evangelical obsession with abortion, but also trans issues, gay marriage. These are cultural issues, somehow separate from politics or inferior to politics in some sense. But these issues around sexuality, gender roles, these are really, really, really central to the evangelical worldview, right? It's very crucial. This is not some kind of distraction.
No, and I think that the etymology of economy, for instance, is that it is the management of the household. And I think that Republicans have been great at kind of tying the kind of market order they want to the type of moral order that evangelicals want in the household, of their own household, to like show personal responsibility, to, you know, have control over your sexuality, these kind of things that it should be echoed all throughout society. I think people, I did mention that I think the pro-life position is incoherent intrinsically, but I think it is part of a broader worldview that does all hang together. And leftists who are just trying to find contradictions and show up hypocrisy or think that, well, we can distract them with these pure pocketbook issues and like, that's delusional. Like it all goes together for them. And I think they're right that it all goes together. What the problem with it isn't that it's hypocritical or that it's contradictory. The problem is that it's destructive.
So what's the overarching philosophy that holds it all together?
I think it's a philosophy centered on appropriate hierarchies, that there are some forms of life that are simply better. There are some lifestyles that are more divinely ordained. Everything else is a kind of deviation from that. That really, for instance, by telling people that they shouldn't engage in homosexuality, it's not just that we're grossed out and we don't want to see that or something like that. They tell themselves that actually heterosexuality is the superior way. It's the way that God wanted them to be. And the fact that they have these feelings is a burden, but they should find a way to participate in the fullness of God's plan for their life or whatever.
And of course, part of those hierarchies are that man is over woman.
Yes, absolutely. And getting back to the original point about segregation, I mean, there is a racial hierarchy too. I think a lot of evangelicals, they aren't like hardcore biological racists or something like that. They're more the cultural racists who just like, well, you know, black people just haven't gotten their act together somehow.
The Catholics, the reactionary Catholics, are also centering trans issues as well. This has given new life to that reactionary religious worldview.
Yeah, I think it's shocking. I mean, there was a letter that the governor of Utah wrote to accompany his veto of a trans athlete ban in schools, and he said he had tracked down that there were three individuals involved. Like this, all of this activism was for like three kids who weren't even like that good or something like that. And so, I mean, it's kind of shocking. Clearly their reaction and the measures they're taking are far out of proportion to any impact that trans people could have. It's clearly a lot of, you know, it's like gender trouble that they're experiencing. Like there's clearly something deeply disturbing about the existence of trans people to them.
But it would also, you know, violate God's rules and overturn hierarchies and divisions that are, you know, divinely inspired, right? I mean, it's a challenge to God's law.
Yes, exactly. Their existence, like the gender binary, is one of their most important hierarchical kind of foundations. And so I think that, yeah, the existence of trans people who don't fall into either category neatly or who are able to move between the two of them, even if they only want to move one direction and then remain there, that still, it can't exist. And so they want to make it not exist.
So knowing all this, is there a better way to fight it than we have?
Trying to win them over or trying to argue with them or show or like find common ground. You know, God says that we should take care of creation, so you should be an environmentalist. Like, they don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear the Bible quoted to them from outsiders. I think that they're basically unreachable. And I think that the only strategy is to mobilize the majority of people who oppose their views and shut them out of power. And I think that part of the problem is that Democrats simply don't want to do that. I think that Democrats think that they would lose more by mobilizing that population than they would gain by shutting the radical right wing out of national politics.
But they're very well organized.
Yes, the right wing. Yeah, it's probably the most well-organized political force in the U.S. Currently, unfortunately.
I mean, the churches themselves are like real political units and political organizations.
Yeah. And that might speak to, you know, stripping them of their tax-exempt status or something like that. But again, Democrats don't want to do that because they still have this fantasy of winning over the suburban soccer mom who now has become the megachurch mom or something. It's very frustrating.
That was Adam Kotzko, a theologian who teaches in the Scheimer Great Books Program at North Central College in Illinois. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. When Adam Kotzko was on the show in 2019, he talked some about how Amy Grant's 1982 indecently catchy song, I Have Decided, a cover of a song by Christian songwriter and singer Michael Card, summarized some core points of the movement's theology. You need not be good to be saved. In fact, that could result in unseemly pride. Adam said that evangelicals like to joke about how hell is full of good people. Or as Card says via Grant here, so forget the game of being good in your self-righteous pain, because the only good inside your heart is the good that Jesus brings. Being saved comes from being born again. You don't have to give a damn about your neighbor. Don't abort your fetus, but once the kid is born, it's all on them. Till next week, bye.